This week's episode is brought to you by Kevel's Retail Media Cloud. Built on an API-first foundation, this platform empowers retail media networks to flexibly customize ad experiences and enhance their data control, resulting in more tailored ad experiences for users. Don't settle for black box limitations or the costs of building alone. Kevel's Retail Media Cloud brings together the power of ad serving and CDP personalization to create on-site ads for retailers and marketplaces in a privacy-safe way. Launch a retail media network that your advertisers will love in as little as 14 days. To learn more, go to kevel.com/listen. That's kevel.com/listen. Welcome to the Marketecture Podcast. I'm Ari Paparo. I'm joined today by Eric Franchi and our special guest, Josh Chazen, who is a renowned leader in the area of measurement. Josh, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Absolutely.
I want to let everyone know about a special episode we're doing next week, which is called Listeners Strike Back, where we have folks who have heard our content in the past and they are reacting to it, hopefully positively. We'll see. It's a really good episode. You should definitely listen to it. And then we'll be back with our regular format the week after that. Eric and I are speaking soon. So Eric, you want to talk about that?
Yes. Listeners, you have an opportunity to actually give Ari feedback in person to his face and shake my hand and tell me how great my jokes are. So there's a new event happening in April. It is called the Ad Tech Economic Forum. It's happening on April 24th in New York City at the Times Center. It's the first time they're doing it. It's being dubbed an attempt to be kind of the Davos of ad tech. And Ari's speaking, I'm speaking, Sir Martin Sorrell, Rashad Tabakawala, Joe Marchese. I mean, they really got some awesome speakers there. And the goal is to talk about all things economic as it relates to the industry. So venture investors, PE, analysts, so on and so forth. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you'd like to go, the hosts, Tom and Rob Beeler, have graciously given Marketecture listeners a code. So check it out. Go to adtecheconforum.com. So it's not ad tech economic, adtecheconforum.com. Click register now and add the code Marketecture Podcast, all lowercase. That's Marketecture Podcast. You get 20% off the price of a ticket and get to hang with Ari and me and many more in person.
All right. Looking forward to that. I love when people come say hello and tell me what I was wrong about. So Josh has been at the forefront of TV measurement for over 20 years at places like Arbitron, Comscore, where he was there for quite some time, and most recently at VideoAmp. Probably many of you have heard him speak or seen him at conferences. He is the guy to talk to if you want to talk about measurement. So a lot's going on here. We have the JIC that we've talked about numerous times on this pod. I'm not sure I understand really what the big picture is right now. So I was hoping just to start off by having you tell us what's going on in the area of media measurement. What's the current state of play?
I'm glad you asked me a nice narrow scope question. So a couple things. I often say that the biggest sea change in the practice of audience measurement in my career is what's going on now, which is the migration from survey sampling to data science, right? So when I started, you know, back in the late 40s, the quintessential audience measurement professional was a survey sampling statistician, someone like, if you remember, Marty Frankel or Dale Metzger. Now the quintessential audience measurement practitioner is a data scientist. So we don't, and that's a radical sea change. It changes everything. So we no longer start with the notion of drawing a sample, whether it's a TV meter panel, whether it's a digital panel, whether it's a diary sample. We start with the notion that there is a ton of data assets available that provide signal. And we can collect this signal, amass it, clean it, and use data science to turn it into insights. So I was looking at this recently. The top-rated show in 1971 was All in the Family, and it had a 34 rating. And not long ago, I was on a panel with Andrea Zapata, who at the time was at Warner Discovery. And I said, you know, 20 years ago, 0.7 was a rounding error. Now, and she interrupts me and she goes, now it's a hit. So the audiences are so fragmented. People have on-demand viewing, so you can't just say, if I'm watching Law & Order SVU, we're all watching it from 10 to, you know, from 9 to 10. It doesn't work like that anymore. So you can't attempt to measure such fragmented granular behavior with a sample or a panel. Fortunately, we have the opportunity presented by technology, by big data assets, and by data science. That has implications economically for the industry, because even though you pay dearly to access these big data assets, whether it's smart TV data, whether it's set-top box data, whether it's digital census data, the estimates I've heard for what Nielsen spends on their national TV panel a year run from $250 to $500 million.
Wow, that's a lot. And that's like trucks and guys going into your house installing boxes.
Yeah.
And lots of data scientists and lots of other things, right?
Yeah, yeah. So what happens is, even though buying Comcast data or buying Vizio data isn't cheap, it's way cheaper than building a $400 million panel. So measurement has become democratized. So now you've got, you know, Rentrak ComScore was the first, and then you've got iSpot, you've got VideoAmp, my until recently company, even Nielsen with Nielsen One, building measurement solutions with big data. And the economics change, which means multiple players can survive. And now the question becomes, what's going to happen in that one?
Right. And this really started. I remember when this started, because in the early days of digital measurement, you had Nielsen Net Ratings, you had ComScore, and it still was panels. And then at some point, ComScore made the switch and started asking its publishers to pixel all their pages. It was called census measurement as opposed to panel measurement. And Nielsen was like, oh, my God, how do we do that? That sounds really hard. And I happened to be there at that time, so that it was kind of hard. But you sort of trade in one set of problems for another. Like, running a panel is very expensive and hard, but running a census business where you try to get every piece of data you can is also really hard, because it's uneven and you have bias in the way the data is collected. Like things like set-top boxes that don't know when someone's not watching the TV, and all kinds of other data science problems that you've probably run into in your career.
So there's an interesting paradox, I think, which is that, so let's say Nielsen, they've got a panel. If the network is large enough to show up, they'll measure every network. But paradoxically, we think, oh, you know, streaming is where the viewing is migrating to. And that's fabulous, because we can get a census of the data for streaming, whether we get server logs, whether we pixel the content or pixel the ads, except that that requires the cooperation of the content providers. So paradoxically, we have the opportunity for census data, which gives us a situation where we have giant holes.
Right. If you have a panel, you can see everything they see because they opted in. But if you're trying to get census data and someone like YouTube decides not to give it to you, you're shit out of luck.
YouTube and Amazon and Netflix is something like 70% of streaming, and they don't let the smart TV manufacturers turn on the ACR tech when they're on the screen from the native app. So,
which brings up the general thought that I've always had, which is the measurement business is incredibly political. It's about different constituencies pulling in different directions because they want things to be measured in the way that benefits them. The customers are very powerful, but so are the distributors. And as a measurement person, you just want to measure things. You know, you just want to have the right answer. But the right answer varies depending on who's paying for it.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I think that one of the core dynamics is look, let's not kid ourselves. I don't want to make any enemies with the good people at Paramount and NBCU, et cetera. But let's not kid ourselves. We know that there's this inexorable trend of migrating of viewership to digital. They're trying to get that with their streaming platforms. But, you know, if you ask it, you go to a local TV market, ask the TV stations who their biggest competitor is. They don't say each other. They say Google. The TV networks, I mean, you know, the ANA and the VAB had a falling out over building this panel. And the falling out was over Google. So
what was that? Could you give us a little more color on that?
Yeah, there were, I guess, two areas of falling out. One was that the TV broadcasters wanted whatever was going to be done with a panel to include metadata on the kind of content because they don't want advertisers to evaluate their high quality primetime programming on the same footing as cat videos. And, you know, quality right. should matter. And then the other thing was that there was this whole snafu that was revealed where Google was placing ads in places on the Google Ad Network that maybe weren't where the buyers thought they were going to end up. And so the golden spike between the ANA, which had Google in their coalition, and the Video Advertising Bureau, which is essentially a trade association for TV networks, kind of fell apart.
And we have Adalytics, the people who created that report, are back in the news. We'll talk about them a little later today.
That's right. Yep.
They're causing all kinds of problems. Yeah. So will Nielsen ever be displaced? That's kind of the hard question. In the U.S. TV measurement market, let's just be precise.
VideoAmp was the third company that I worked at that attempted to compete with Nielsen in national TV ratings. First was Arbitron, and the second was Comscore. At three companies, we would talk to both buyers and sellers, and they would say, oh, I hate Nielsen. I'm sick of Nielsen. They get everything wrong. And then we would show them our data. And the more different our number was from the Nielsen number, the more splaining we had to do. And, you know, I think what people really want is a whole new service that does everything differently but comes up with the exact
same
thing.
For less. They want a cheaper
for
Nielsen.
For less, yeah. Yeah, or maybe that shows them a little bit higher in the ranking. But here's the thing. So I felt like Nielsen has this tremendous advantage, which is incumbency. There are what I call switching costs. To changing your currency on whether you're an agency or a seller, and really especially the agencies, because they don't have excess labor to devote to the work a switch of currencies would take. So I felt like Nielsen One, the migration from Nielsen to Nielsen One, was an opportunity of a career, because all of a sudden, Comscore and VideoAmp and iSpot and Nielsen were all quote-unquote alternative currencies. And I figured as long as you, the user of currency data, has to make a change, you might as well pick the best one. So even if you stick with Nielsen, you're still going to go through switching costs. So Nielsen did the smart thing, which was they punted down the road a year. So now the especially the agencies, let's say, don't have to make a currency change decision, which means they don't have to devote the labor to a currency change decision for another year because they still have Nielsen. Here's the thing, Ari. I see, by the way, you're looking at your mic that you want to ask me a question. let me just finish this point here. So the new currencies, the big data currencies, have gotten the most traction in what we're calling advanced TV, you know, streaming, and also, you know, non-age gender targets, but other types of advanced targets. I think that's because nobody has 50 years of auto intender historical data. So it's really easy to move that money. And now the question becomes, two-part question. A, how fast is the money going to move from age gender to advanced targets? And then B, will the buyers and sellers, seeing that they're using the new currencies for advanced targets, retrofit to using it for demography as well? That's kind of where I think the dynamic is going to be.
For those of our listeners who aren't experts in the area, can you give a quick explanation of the difference between Nielsen and Nielsen One?
To the extent that I understand it. But Nielsen is the legacy system that is panel-based. They have a national panel. It's an extremely high-quality panel, as a panel goes, something like 40,000 households, where they collect all the viewing behavior and project that. Nielsen One is their introduction of big data to the landscape, like VideoAmp and Comscore and iSpot are doing with smart TV data and set-top box data, so that instead of having 40,000 households where you know everything that's going on in the household, you can have 10, 20, 30, 40 million households where you get the data either from the MVPD, the cable provider, or from the smart TV manufacturer.
Do the numbers line up for larger ratings between the two systems, or is it totally non-compatible?
What we have observed is that, well, I'm going to say the big data currencies for linear TV, which is where you got an apples to apples comparison, the overall numbers are kind of similar, although the users will say when you get down to the smaller ratings, they can vary by high percents. But the biggest trend I saw was that the new currencies show more viewers to 18 to 49, and Nielsen Legacy shows more viewers to 50 plus. And I forget, was it Nexstar that bought the CW? And there was an article in the trades about how the average age of the CW was 54. The mean age of the CW was 54. The CW, right? Which means that for every 40-year-old watching The Flash, there's somebody 68 watching The Flash. And I think that all these crazy old median ages for TV networks, to some extent, are an artifact of panel bias.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And I will also tell you that, yeah, and you know what? I poked around and I asked some friends at TV networks, does Nielsen One show as much of the viewing 50 plus as the panel does? And what I heard was no, that the big data based currencies, including Nielsen One, tend to distribute more of the viewing to the under 49s. Now, it's still, believe me, TV still skews old.
Yeah, don't tell the pharmaceutical companies this. They're going to have to change their media plans pretty dramatically.
Yeah, no, it still skews old, but not as old as we had been led to believe.
These measurement bias things really matter, and they have big impacts. I remember when I was at Nielsen, there was this whole controversy that the Miami sample wasn't measuring native Spanish speakers very well. So all of the Spanish language media was being underreported and therefore making less money, which was bad for the community. And it was a real brouhaha. I don't know how they ended up fixing that. So you're coming off a pretty big stint at VideoAmp, where I think it's fair to say you brought them to the table as a major legit measurement company. Without saying anything you're not supposed to say, what's it like at VideoAmp? I mean, is it really, were you doing CrossFit all day? Was Ross like, you know, pumping iron? Is it?
So here's the thing. I mean, going on. So here's the thing. So like the average colleague of mine at VideoAmp was 28, you know, like, so I just didn't consider, I'm not going to say how old I am, but I'm freaking old. So like, I just didn't consider myself a consumer of the culture. Okay. I understood the culture. I appreciated how it brought the teams together. Hey, let's all go do CrossFit across the street at the gym with Ross at 7 a.m. And I'd be like, yeah, I'll see you guys at 9:30 when I wander in. You know, no knocks on the culture, but I'm not the best person to ask about it because I very quickly ascertained that I was not the audience for it.
Yeah, so on the business side, they have new leadership.
And I'm weighing, and I'm not flexible enough. Flexible.
If I picked up a kettlebell, you would immediately hear my back crack, and not in a good way. But like,
yeah,
what is their position? They have new leadership. Is there anything you want to say about, you know, what the future looks like for them?
Yeah, I will. And I'm going to be very transparent with you and with your listeners. And the first thing I'm going to say is that I still have a whole bunch of stock options in VideoAmp, and I need them to be freaking worth something. So I have not stopped advocating for VideoAmp, even though I don't work there anymore. But here's the thing. So the new leadership, the main two people you point to are Peter Liguori and Pete Bradbury, who came from Nielsen. As far as Peter Liguori is concerned, I have to say, I freaking love the guy. I was very fond of him. I hope we stay friends. I think that being the person running VideoAmp is probably not his first choice right now. I think that he has some really exciting other businesses that have to do with show business and making programs for Netflix. I think that's probably what he really wants to do. But, you know, there's a need for some adult supervision. As far as Pete Bradbury is concerned, when I was there, I was telling VideoAmp for like 2 years, we need to hire somebody who knows how to sell TV ratings to television networks. It's not ad tech. It's audience measurement, and they're not the same thing. And you can ask Pete Bradbury, and he'll confirm this. I recruited the guy. Like, I knew him from being on the ARF board together and met with him a few times, and then I sent him to the head of HR and to Pete Liguori, and I said, hire this freaking guy. Like, this is the guy. Unfortunately, I thought we'd work together. That didn't pan out, but I think he was a great hire, and I think that he is going to bring the kind of discipline and industry expertise and the understanding of how you make a ratings deal with a giant network company that perhaps they didn't have before.
I want to ask Eric a question. So, Eric, you invest a lot in the TV and related subjects, TV Scientific being a big investment for you. Does what Josh is saying scare you, that it's like not SaaS, selling stuff, it's hard to measure, it's like, it feels very non-linear with the way tech businesses were, this whole TV and measurement thing?
Yeah, I would agree, but there is a wall of money that is coming into streaming, whether you like it or not, whether the measurement challenges are going to be fixed in 2024, 2025 or not. And there's all the performance-based marketers, let alone that, you know, measure things differently, that, you know, are causing, you know, I think the landscape to shift a little bit. So, you know, it's like, you know, would I prefer things to be cleaner and measurement to be, you know, kind of better understood? Yes. But at the same time, there's, you know, a little bit of that opportunity in chaos, which from a venture perspective, if you like take that and then, you know, times it by the market size, like, you know, it's just, you know, an awesome category from our perspective to invest in. It's one of the biggest categories from investment for us and others.
Josh, so one last subject. So we talked about VideoAmp, another former employer of yours, Comscore, has been languishing. It's been a terrible stock to own. It's had scandals. It's had all kinds of problems.
Don't remind me.
Are you still a shareholder of Comscore? Okay, we'll skip that subject.
I have almost $1,500 of Comscore stock. I don't want to tell you what it used to be.
What is there any future for that company? Are they going to get acquired? Are they going to revive? I mean, it feels like they're right in the middle of stuff, but they can't capitalize it from a commercial perspective.
You know, yeah, I hate to speculate. I think that they've lost some market confidence because their financial situation is making it hard for them to invest, you know, to do things. They have a strong position in the local marketplace. But, you know, look, when I worked at Comscore back in the 2007 to 2000, whatever, 20, you know, we had customers like Google, Facebook, Yahoo, you know, and now their strongest customer base is the companies who own TV stations in markets 110. So I think they have some interesting parts, but I'm not sure how they go together as a whole. And I don't know. The other thing I'm going to tell you, by the way, Eric, you probably know this because I gather you're an investor and a finance whiz. But their book value is something like $70, $80 million. But there's also like $300 million of preferred stock. And that, I think, maybe complicates the notion of acquiring them. I think they look good. Look, I'm not an investor. I'm not a finance guy. I think they look good as a company that could be combined with another company that had complementary assets.
Yeah, and in measurement, the problem is there's enough concentration that if, like, Nielsen can't buy them, for example. You'd end up with antitrust issues.
And also, Ari, Nielsen, as far as I know, Nielsen, Comscore, and Kantar are all, you know, on the block. And who's going to buy them if not each other?
Right, and they can't buy each other generally. All right, this is a great conversation. We're going to take a quick break and come back with the news of the week. Lots of news. We have the Media Link juicy story. We have TikTok bans. We have the analytics report. This is like a prime week for news. So we'll be back in just a minute.
This is a message from our sponsor. I'd like to introduce you to Publica by IAS, the award-winning CTV ad server trusted by some of the biggest streaming services and smart TV manufacturers globally. Publica helps a growing number of leading AVOD and FAST services to power the programmatic ad break decisioning via products including a unified auction, server-side ad insertion, and a demand-agnostic ad server built from the ground up around streaming. Head to getpublica.com to find out how they help CTV publishers to grow their advertising revenues and provide streaming audiences with linear-like TV ad break experiences.
All right, and we're back. As I already said, we have some juicy stuff to go over this week. I think we'll take it from the top. We're recording this on Thursday, March 14th. Yesterday, you might have woken up to a flurry of articles about MediaLink. So for those who are unfamiliar with MediaLink, it's an advisory firm was started by Michael Kassin, has a great reputation for doing good work across a few things. So they help brands with their agency reviews, agencies and the ecosystem sort of kind of, you know, meet each other via events and things like that. They do executive search and, you know, general advisory business. It was acquired twice, first by Essential and then most recently by UTA in 2021. So yesterday the news came out that Michael Kassin, who, you know, is basically synonymous with MediaLink, the company he started, is out. There's two stories. So UTA is claiming that they fired him for cause, basically misuse of funds. And these funds seem to be around this $1 million or $950,000 expense budget. And then Kassin claims that he resigned, can't be fired, and he is suing them for fraud and breach of contract. So yikes. Interestingly, he forfeited $10 million of severance that would be owed to him if he didn't start a competing business. So I think you know, there's a couple of things to talk about here, and I'll throw it to both of you. So number one, you know, having been in the space for a long time, as I said, like Kassin is synonymous with MediaLink. So if there's no Michael Kassin at MediaLink, is there a MediaLink?
Yeah, was there ever a MediaLink? What was it? What was it? I've been on the side.
I defined it before. I thought I did a decent job defining it.
But like my experience with MediaLink is more or less someone in marketing telling me I had to pony up $10,000 a month and me asking what I was going to get for it and not getting an answer and then being forced to give them the money anyway. And I got invited to some nice parties, but I don't socialize very well at nice parties. So it was not a great ROI for me. I once rented a picnic table from them for $25,000. That was in New Mexico where they had this scam where they had like five picnic tables and they called it the Startup Center by MediaLink and they charged you $25,000 to rent one. And I actually did it. So I guess the message here is that I'm not good with budgets, probably better than Kazan is at budgets, given his alleged $500,000 personal credit card bill that the company paid and his driver's rent and the other allegations, which just make the story a fun one and a bit juicy.
So from a vendor perspective, oftentimes, you know, ad tech companies, platforms, you know, will hire MediaLink to help them get connected to the ecosystem, the brand halo, everything like that. You know, one of the things that I think would be interesting to talk about, and we don't have to spend too much time on it, is in an age where there's like increasing concentration in walled gardens, in an age where AI is going to be doing more and more of just this like work and decisioning, is a MediaLink as relevant as it once was, right, in just a different era?
I think there's something to say for that. I can't imagine MediaLink was very effective at getting you the right audience at a Google or a Facebook, because it's culturally, those companies don't care about relationships that much. They care about algorithms. And so the relationship, that ability to get connected with the right person at the right company and have your point of view expressed to them is much more relevant to what you might call the less efficient older world of media than future.
Right, right. No, exactly. So it's going to be interesting to watch. Ari will post the articles. Probably there's a bunch of them in the newsletter, but the filings are, you know, like, I mean, people are having a field day looking through the filings.
Pour one out for the driver. You know, he no longer has his rent paid and will have to find gainful employment driving someone else. It's a tragedy for everyone involved.
Moving on. So TikTok, we talked about this last week. And, you know, this is another one that's like, wow. So reading the headline here, House passes bill that could lead to a TikTok ban, fight shifts to the Senate. So the House approved the legislation dubbed the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act. That calls for China tech giant ByteDance to divest TikTok or the popular social video app will effectively be banned in the U.S. The bill now heads to the Senate, where it faces an uncertain future as senators appear to be divided about the legislation. So looks like there's a chance that TikTok is banned and removed from app stores and presumably removed from phones, which I think is going to be chaos and unprecedented, and kids are going to be picketing in the streets. Or it can get sold. And there's some rumors of, you know, some syndicates being put together. If it is indeed sold to U.S. company, I mean, it's probably going to be like a $100 million deal. So either way, this is like
100 million. You mean 100? You mean 100 billion, right?
Billion.
100 billion.
Billion.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Billion. Yeah. Yeah.
100 billion.
Well, also some additional points of data around this. Everyone's favorite politician, Mr. Trump, has suddenly switched sides. And while he was trying to ban TikTok when he was president, now he thinks it's a great idea and that he wants all the young voters to see that he's trying to protect it. That's really ridiculous.
He feels that way because Facebook was mean to him.
He says Mark Zuckerberg's the real enemy of the people.
Yeah, which is,
really quite fascist. And then there's also been some reporting that the CCP will not allow this to happen, that they would rather shut it down than have it sold. I don't know if they speak with United Voice over there, if they're putting out press releases, but that's been the feeling is that they're not going to let the algorithm switch hands into American hands, which is enough evidence for me that it really needs to be banned.
So I'm seeing two things. One is the congresspersons and senators that I've seen interviewed are very, they want to emphasize that this is not a vote to ban TikTok. It is a vote to require divestment. You know, maybe a distinction without a difference, but they're, you know, they seem to be bullish that a sale can be made. But my second thing is like, just because that's what Congress decides, and let's say it gets ratified by the president, what makes ByteDance want to sell them? You know, like, what if they just said, no, thank you? I mean, is there economic incentive for them to sell that company? It's just not clear to me.
Right. Well, I think the bill would order the app stores to remove.
Oh, no. Okay. So they've got no more business in the U.S., but there's a whole lot of world left.
True. Although the ARPU of the other social networks in the United States absolutely dwarfs the ARPU in other countries.
Yeah, yeah.
So another interesting thing here is that the bill gives 6 months to comply. So if it was signed in the next couple of weeks, we'd be talking about October, right before the presidential election. So I don't think Biden wants that. Even if he has said he would sign it, but I can't imagine him wanting to sign it in the next like 45 days. Yeah. So I think you might see some maneuvering around that subject to try to sign it such that it'll be the new president's problem, either him or the other guy.
I think the White House is banking on the bill not getting out of Congress. The House passes it. The Senate doesn't. I think that's what they're banking.
Yeah, and who could buy it? Maybe it could be the great combination that was proposed a couple of years ago of Oracle and Walmart. That made a lot of sense. Those names just, you know, at the tip of your fingers, who would buy this? Oracle and Walmart. That makes total sense.
I would be quite comfortable with all of the data being in the hands of Oracle and Walmart. Though.
I think I'd rather the communists have it than Oracle have it.
Unbelievable. Okay. All right. News item number three. Again, and inside ad tech, this is about as juicy as it gets. So another Adalytics report. This one, James Hercher broke the news. This is a really good one. Adalytics report torches ad tech for touting MFA prevention while scarfing MFA supply. My God, what a headline. So basically, it says that SSPs that remove MFA inventory are not rewarded by buyers. And the largest platforms, namely Microsoft, Google, and Amazon, are showing their ads on MFA sites more than anyone. Amazon was called out specifically for the first time. This isn't all about Google, as particularly troubling because A, the scale is tremendous, and B, product listing ads are measured on view-based conversions. So it's very troubling from, you know, not just like a, you know, throwing away money on impression standpoint. It could be like wreaking havoc on measurement and attribution. On the positive side, TTD and Basis were called out for doing a really good job of avoiding these sites. So it shows that it can be done. But man, Adalytics just keeps coming with this stuff. And it doesn't appear that all of this work that everybody's talking about making that much
sense. Yeah, I think it's important to understand the methodology here because it's different from the methodology that they had used in their previous reports. In their previous reports, they had used log files from actual advertisers who were customers of Adalytics. In this example, they effectively simulated the browsing environment. They had a fake user profile that then went to these sites and refreshed them many, many times to see what ads showed up. So it's a little more empirical, but there is some kind of potential bias in their methodology because these were not real users. It didn't have real profiles that might encourage people to bid on them. And the outputs are sort of what you would expect, which is you would see advertisements from very broad sets of buyers who might not be doing any audience targeting and might be doing just contextual. And as a result, Google, Microsoft, Amazon had the most demand being shown on this. I think it's also interesting that on the sell side, basically everyone was guilty. You know, when they list the SSPs that were selling ads on these pages, it was every single SSP. Notably, it was Google was number one. So Google was number one on the buy and the sell side on MFA. And I think that comports with what we've seen previously in this area.
Josh, don't you love that you don't have to deal with this MFA stuff in TV land?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well said. Okay. All right. Next news piece. Sam Altman is coming for you, agencies. So I'm going to read this. There was a new book that was just published called Our AI Journey. There was a little bit of a viral post about something that Sam Altman, co-founder and CEO at OpenAI, said about marketing. So the question was, and I think this was posed by someone that runs an agency, what do you think AGI, general artificial intelligence, will mean for us and for consumer brand marketers trying to create ad campaigns and the like to build their companies? Sam Altman says, oh, for that? It will mean that 95% of what marketers use, agencies, strategists, and creative professionals for today will easily, nearly instantly, and at almost no cost, be handled by the AI. And the AI will likely be able to test the creative against real or synthetic customer focus groups for predicting results and optimizing. Again, all free, instant, nearly perfect. Images, videos, campaign ideas, no problem.
Eric, thank you so much for finding this, because I'm writing my newsletter on Monday about this subject. I asked my AI, I'm using Perplexity because you convinced me to use that. So I asked Perplexity how many employees some of the big holding companies have, and it spit out some answers. Publicis has 98,000, WPP has 100,000, Dentsu has 65,000. A lot of people. A lot of people. And then the second thing I did was I started Googling, you know, what's WPP doing in AI? And by the way, we have the CTO of WPP coming on the show in a couple of weeks. So it'll be really interesting to talk to him. So I Googled each of the major holding companies, what's Dentsu doing in AI? And, you know, the investment levels are, you know, not what you'd expect for a company, for very large companies that are about to get wickedly disrupted. Just what's been announced, I mean, this may not be entirely accurate, but Publicis has a program called Core AI, where they're investing $325 million over 3 years. Sounds like a lot, but like that's $100 million a year compared to, you know, what, you know, OpenAI is investing, which is billions a year. And WPP has a system called IQ, where they say they're investing $317 million. I think that's an annual number, so that's pretty impressive. The other major holding companies, all their press releases are effectively using AI or partnering with Amazon to use AIs for better creative development, pretty small bore kind of investments. I'm kind of a little bit shocked at what I found when I did a little research on this. I mean, Lord knows I should not be the CEO of a holding company, but if I were, I would be absolutely panicked over this. I'd be trying to shift my entire ship towards this, because if I'm selling people, I'm going to have nothing to sell in a couple of years.
Lately, I've come to think, and by the way, you know, I've been thinking about this in the whole context of what we talked about earlier, which is currency, but holding companies, large agencies, make their money by maximizing this fraction. The numerator is dollars spent, and the denominator is labor costs. And what's going to happen is, I think, that AI is going to immediately have an impact on labor costs. And the agencies that don't embrace AI are going to find that they got a competitive problem, because they are offering the same services as their competitors, but they're spending too much to do it. So I think that you're going to end up in, they're reticent to move in this direction because they think that their asset is people. Everybody thinks their asset is people. But once their competitors start competing for business in a more efficient fashion with way fewer labor costs, that's going to accelerate the adoption of AI across the industry.
Josh, I have a question for you on this subject.
Will it be
just a follow-up question. Do you think the data inside agencies is a valuable asset for them to be creating AI. Things like, you know, 50 years of media planning and buying and measurement and things like that. Do they have any data assets that they should be leveraging for this?
Yes and no. Okay. I'm going to say yes, because they do have the data, but no, because how much of the data about All in the Family having a 34 rating in 1971 is going to be relevant to the fragmentation today? You know, a lot of what's going on in media spending today has 4 years of history, tops. So, yeah.
I do wonder if the future is, you know, going to be transformation by holdcos to really, you know, lead in AI. Our first podcast of the year was with Bill Wise. He said that was his prediction. But just given how fast these tools are coming online and the capabilities and some of the things, frankly, that we're seeing with startups, I just wonder if it's going to be a new breed of agency that is.
Yeah.
People light. And, you know, technology adept. And, you know, like my friends out in Silicon Valley, they're obsessed with this idea of like $1 billion 1 to 5 person companies. I kind of wonder if the first one might be an agency.
If AI lets you create the advertising with a minimal number of heads, and programmatic lets you place the advertising, maybe holding companies are dinosaurs very quickly.
AI is never going to be David Ogilvy. It's never going to come up with Coke is it. But if you come up with Coke is it, and you have the colors and you have the concepts and the feel of the brand and the strategy, you can then do the next 500 person's work automatically, right? And that's an opportunity for a lot of leverage.
Yeah, it feels like, you know, this is just like an intense period of change, you know, just with the MediaLink announcement and then this thing just casually dropped. It's pretty wild out there. All right, we'll do one more and we'll get going. All right, this is one you wanted to talk about. So there was a announcement by Magnite and MediaOcean. So buyers can book campaigns from Prisma and effectively skip their DSP entirely.
Yeah, basically, it's a bit of a coup, I think, for Magnite. So Magnite has been pushing their product, whatever it's called, OpenPath, ClearPath, ClearChannel. I can't remember what it's called. But they've been pushing...
ClearLine?
What is it called? ClearEyed? ClearEyed can't lose.
ClearLine?
No, they have this product that lets you buy video directly without using a DSP. And they have this now this exclusive relationship with MediaOcean. MediaOcean is sort of this incredible software dashboard with deep penetration in all the agencies. And it allows a buyer to buy video direct on a guaranteed sort of future contract. And I spoke informally, so I hope I'm not saying this out of turn, with Ramsey at the CTV Connect conference yesterday about this. And he was saying that he really feels like there are many media planners and buyers who see programmatic as replacing the old way of buying TV. And this fits right into that versus the more digital buyers who see connected TV as enhancing what they've been doing in a biddable environment. And that's not really who this is meant for.
Makes total sense. Bill Wise strikes again.
Exactly.
All right. There's a bunch more news, but we'll probably call it here. Or I'll put them in the newsletter. All right.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great episode. Josh, thank you so much for being here. This was a really great discussion.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Eric, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Josh.
Look out for the newsletter on Monday, where I'll talk about agencies, a subject I know very little about. And next week, we have, like I said, a special episode, Listeners Strike Back. So look forward to that. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for subscribing to Marketecture. New interviews are added every week at marketecture.tv and your favorite podcasting app.